special system was Sun Network File System, because in before you had more or less localized file systems available, supported by the operating system. And one of the things was here to have a network extension for the distributed file management. It existed already in some special systems, like from Xerox operating systems, but there it was basically in a specialized environment. Here with Sun NFS, it was more or less then open widely, and it's available on Windows, on Unix, on Mac OS. And some of the characteristics, we can look at it. It's basically here you could mount remote parts of a file system and then integrate it into your own environment and then basically have remote access to the remote file server. And it's basically here RPC-based. That means they make here remote procedure calls across the network. And the important thing is it's transparent for the user. And therefore, in that sense, the software doesn't have to be specially designed. You can use here regular read and write operations independent if that read happens to a local file or if the read happens to a or a write happens to a remote file. And important here is also here we have something what we called marshalling of remaining path name. And what I mean with that, usually you access files via path names. And here, if you start here, and I mean, it's we can then put here files on this part. If you specify the file name, like from the root org, then sys, and then use the file name A. Basically, this first part is used to navigate through that file system, and then you come to the mount. Then you take the remaining file name, like here, the org, then sys, then A. You take the remaining file name here to basically marshal that as take the remaining string, marshal that, send it as an RPC across the network. Here it's unmarshaled again, and then you can basically navigate through that part of the file system. Therefore, in that sense, it uses always the path name until it hits something like here that you have a remote mount, and then ship it over, and then continue on the remote side. You have here a special support for the mount service. This part, it has a file names named etc exports, and it lists the names of the local file system which are available for remote mounting. And it also lists access information. Therefore, in that sense, which hosts are basically permitted to mount that part of the file system. The here, the mounting request basically it's shipped over by the remote or by the client here, and it includes the remote host and the directory path name and the local path, the local name here on that part. You have something like an an automounter, which basically dynamically mounts it. And what it means, it's here, if you hit something like a section of a path name, which refers to an remote mount, then it auto-mounts it. I mean, you can. There is something like a possibility to mount everything at the beginning when the operating system starts, and it goes through all the lists which have to be mounted. Here, with the auto-mounter, it's you can do it dynamically, or you can do it basically on a way when it's needed. And what it returns here, if a mount occurs, you get something like a file handle, and the file handle includes the server IP as well as the port where the remote server is then accessed. Then let's look what else we have. It supports access transparency. Therefore, in that sense, as I mentioned already before, read and write operations, if you use the C library for programming and include it in your C program, but also in a C++ program, you can use just the regular read and write operations independent if it's here a local or remote access of a file. Good. What else do we have? And the certainly with the auto-mounter, you have something like a table which includes the path names as well as the mounting information where to go. And in that sense, then all the mounting is already done dynamically at startup. Important is you have different types of links, especially these hard links as well as soft links. With hard links, it really tries to mount, and it waits until it's able to mount. With a soft link across the network, it has something like repeatedly tries to mount after three or four attempts. Basically, the mount times out and then returns something like NFS not responding, and the system is not really blocked. Okay, what else do we have? And here you see the implementation of it. As I mentioned, we use RPC calls. And the important part of it with NFS, you have something new here, this virtual file system. And when you get a system call for a file access, open, read, or write, or especially open, then the virtual file system has to decide if it's a local access, then it goes to the regular Unix file system, or if it's a remote access, then basically it goes to the NFS client, sends an RPC call, that means it's just a regular message going across the network. There it's handled by the NFS server, going back to the virtual file system, and then it's mapped to a local call to access then the file. If we have something like what we called on this level a vNode or virtual node, and if it's local, this virtual node corresponds to an inode. For people who know Unix programming, it's basically the representation of a file, the inode, where information about length is in it, ownership, modification date, but also information where to find it in the file system, which block. If it's remote, then it corresponds to a file handle. Whoops. And that file handle then basically includes the IP address, then the port to basically find where it's located here on the site here, on the remote site, and also to the path basically for the file name where you start, then to navigate through the file system here. The important part of it, it's the earlier versions of NFS were stateless. That means every call was basically a self-contained entity. Therefore, even in that sense, the server did not store any state information of the client. Therefore, the client has to send a complete access to find the file and to access it. In that sense, even if you do an open here, you get the node information, but you have to send it completely, the file information completely across the network with each read or write operation. The advantage of it is the following, that the server does not keep any state. If the server crashes and it has a restart, it doesn't have to handle any information about stale or old client information. And therefore, server programming is a lot easier. And on the other hand, if the server crashes, then the client basically has to try to contact the server and has to find out when the server is up and running again. The other important part of it is client programming becomes a little bit more complicated, because the client now has to, especially the virtual file system, has to keep the state. What block was accessed last? How to increase the file pointer and things like that? That's all has to be done on this side. The current version of of NFS is somewhat stateful. It's not completely stateful. It's somewhat stateful because what it supports now locking, because the original one didn't provide any locking. Therefore, in that sense, if you have multiple clients accessing the same file, the file server allowed it. And therefore, you might have, or it might have resulted in certain inconsistency, because you had multiple files doing modifications of the same file. Now you support locking. And the other thing is, what it also supports now, caching of information, that basically the whole file can be cached here on that side. And then you get much faster access. And this one knows that it cached the file. But otherwise, it does not keep any state of what's the file pointer position and things like that. That's not handled here. The one thing, what I mentioned, the file handle. Okay, the important part of it here, I already mentioned IP address and port to get the file system. Then what we have here is something like the inode to come to the appropriate file, and the important part, if it is iNode creation number. And the history of it is the following. If you look at Unix file systems, inodes are reused. If you delete the file, then the inode is available for use again. And the file system could decide when somebody else wants to create a file to reuse that inode again to store the file information. And then you might have the problem that if you access the file with open and you might have client-side caching to use that file, have the inode associated, in the meantime, somebody else, and it was not locked, and in the meantime, somebody else decided to delete that file, the file system, and then somebody else comes and creates a file, then you might have a valid inode number, but that inode number refers to some other file which was in the meantime created by somebody else. And then you might try to access the file, and everything is valid except that you access the wrong file, which was changed deleted and recreated in the meantime. And that's the reason why you have this inode creation number. That means if an inode is reused, the inode creation number is increased by a number. And then if you come with a file handle across the network, have an invalid inode creation number, then basically you would get an error message. This type of recognition, if a file was deleted and newly created, you have the same thing also in Windows NTFS. There you also have the file handle, and there you don't have inodes, but you have something similar, and it also has something like a number associated with it. And it could be that you delete a file with the file name and then create a new file with the old name. It gets a new number of it. And if you have the old file handle to the old file, basically you would get a notification that you have an invalid file access. And that's much easier to handle if it's everything local. If it's remote, because if it's remote, this one doesn't know that some other clients might have a current file handle, and they might try to access the file sometime later. You have something similar in object-oriented environments, like object IDs or object information, that you have an information about do you have valid or invalid object IDs. Good, so much for that. And NTFS is pretty similar of it, and with NFS. And it also has it's somewhat stateless, but it has something also stateful features in it, like event notification. If a file had changed, you can get a notification that things changed. The other important influence comes from J2E, and it was developed as part of the Java environment. I mean, at the first you just had the Java programming language, and then you had piece-by-piece extension of the Java environment. It basically, you had two parts of it. On one hand, you had a runtime environment to host applications, and then the other part of it were important APIs to build applications. And for example, database interfaces or interfaces to the mail system and so on. And they allowed them to easily build applications and also on the remote side to access like standard pieces of it. And the objectives from J2E is on one hand it's component based, and this had the consequence to support reuse of programming pieces. And component based means it's not something what RMI does. RMI basically allows the distributed objects across the network, that you might have an objects on different machines, and you are allowed within your application to basically invoke methods of a remote object. Here, components mean you have a whole bundle of object, put that together in a, let's say, heavyweight piece, and then you reuse these components. Therefore, in that sense, it's from the abstraction a little bit higher than distributed objects. Objects is a very fine granularity of programming. J2E, it's more like on a coarse granularity of programming. The other important part of it was also with legacy applications. And J2E was for, like, let's say, enterprise programming, and for large companies to do their distributed applications. And an important part of it to incorporate legacy applications. Legacy means can be CORBA applications, but it also means that it could be like management information systems, which possibly are also programmed in COBOL or in other, let's say, historic languages. And the nowadays, it also supports web services, and therefore, in that sense, it allows loose coupling. Before, all the when you had here this part of it, it was more like tight coupling. J2E was pretty tight coupled because it uses used RMI or equivalent, and therefore you had some really tight dependency between the components across the network. With web services, you got a much looser coupling of it. The runtime infrastructure, as I mentioned, it specifies roles, as well as roles and interfaces. So here, interfaces. And in J2E, it does not mean that J2E exactly prescribes how to implement the runtime infrastructure. Therefore, you got different types of implementation. There are some public open source implementations of it, but there are also implementation like WebSphere, which is from IBM, and you basically have to pay for it. And therefore, in that sense, with the J2E, it more or less prescribes what roles have to be provided and what interfaces have to be provided. But the implementation is free. It can be decided by the company doing it. The extensions, what you get, you have enterprise Java Beans, servlets, server pages. The difference between server pages and servlets is that with server pages, at the beginning, they basically just scriptlets, and it's not executable code. It's more or less when you have an invocation of a server page, it's compiled into a servlet and then executed. And if the next invocation to a server page comes, then basically the servlet is invoked immediately. Therefore, in that sense, first you start from something like a source, and then you compile it into a servlet. Then you have these inter-ORP protocol. The IIOP, that was developed as part of CORBA, and the ORP, that's something like an object request broker, which is used to find where an object is located. For example, you have an object ID, but you don't really know where the object is. Therefore, you need something like an object repository or like a directory service to access it and to find out where it is. And then you access the the appropriate object. This IIOP protocol was then also incorporated into the Java J2E. And because it was pretty successful, the IIOP, one of the things which was pretty successful from CORBA. JNDI, that's something like if... It's, RMI, that's a remote method invocation. Therefore, in that sense, it allows to invoke remote objects. And it's not a service. Certainly, it's you have a service object and you have a client object. In that sense, it's service behavior. But if you look at SOAP, the intention is like web services. These are heavyweight services and not services on an object level. Here, you have the service on an object level. And therefore, you have a mapping that you say, well, you start out with an RMI call, and then you map it into an internet inter-ORP protocol. And then in that sense, you could also now invoke a CORBA object. Because before, if you use RMI, that would mean you start out with RMI. The receiver is also an RMI supporting object to handle the remote method call. Here, you are much more flexible because you could also invoke non-RMI objects. But it's really on an object level and not compared with web services, which are like a coarse granularity if you use web services. And you can also have transactions and also access Java mail and things like that. And if you look at the architecture, it's basically here. You would have here these APIs, and as I already mentioned it, but here you have these containers, And now with these containers, you have different types of it, like do you have Java beans? And like here for managing application components. And there are different types. Do you have, for example, like a web application which consists of servlets and pages, and then you come with the application kinds. The specification, it's a server-side managed component architecture. I mean, this is on a server side. And the intention originally was to have something like a three-tier architecture. You have on one hand clients, you have these containers, and then you would have something like data management. Therefore, in this part, you would have this is the application logic to handle that on the remote side, and then additionally, you would have something like the data management side, and they can be accessed then via these enterprise Java beans. And a bean, more or less, it provides these business interfaces, and it also provides a local interface if you have a local interaction or a remote interface. And then you would require a communication middleware. And if you are purely in the Java environment, usually the application middleware is basically RMI. I mean, for remote use, RMI used as communication middleware. And, well, that's, I think, all to say here. This, most of the things I already mentioned here, the JDBC to access databases, that's especially if you have a three-tier architecture. Then on one hand, client application logic, and then the database management environment. The important part of it, certainly, as you have these application components, you package that into, we can say, packaged into archive files. And therefore, in that sense, it's very easy transportable, and these archive files have something like a deployment descriptor. And if we look at it here, we can see these archive files, and you have different levels of it, the applications of it. These can consist of multiple modules. Here you have all these Java beans into one enterprise Java module. Here these jar files. These are, let's say, deployment files, which provide information, a description of it, like configuration information, like where the state has to be saved. All the things are basically here decided in the in these jar files in it. And here, and this is usually in a description, it's an XML description file. And you have different types of it, depending if it's like an enterprise Java bean, if it's a web description. So you have all these endings, .war or .jr and so on, depending what kind of archive is. And I think that's, yeah, let's say here, description of components, and for example, configuration info, and state, and so on, where the state has to be saved, and so on. You can look at the tutorial or the tutorial of J2E. The last things which was also developed as part of it was this Java server pages, and the important part of it was also this scriptlets. And therefore, in that sense, it looked like the whole thing looked like XML, and scriptlets could be compiled into a servlet. And the important part of it, you could have code fragments in it. Like here, you might have a condition, and the other thing is here, the thing here is it outputs it into the response stream. So here, output into response stream. Therefore, in that sense, it accesses a certain object, gets information out of it, and with this here, you basically you get information and piped into the output stream. And with scriptlet, basically, you generate a web page. And therefore, this refers to the current web page. If we look at object-oriented programming, then you know this term "this," and therefore, in that sense, that refers to the current web page. And if you just use these output, you pipe basically into the current to the current web page, and in that sense, here you get the request from the client. This is the response also, then sent to the client, and here you can put it into the session. Out, basically, you pipe things out, which is then sent to the client. I mean, that just should give you an information what's also was developed as part of the effort of J2E. You have two example implementations, like JBoss. I mean, I don't know if somebody used it already and worked with it, but it's open source. You can download it and program with it, and it's an advanced middleware which basically provides a J2E-based environment for distributed applications. You can also use IBM WebSphere, but that's then proprietary. And this one also includes something like distributed debugging. And because if you think of it, to debugging, it's somewhat a lot more difficult compared like a local debugger, because now you have all these time delays sending from the client to the server. You might have also the delays due to network congestion. And therefore, in the sense, if you specify like timeout intervals, if you use the wrong intervals, you might get always timeouts. And it's not really that you might have wrong implementations. It's something like you might not have adjusted for the congestions in the network. And therefore, in that in that sense, you can then use distributed debugging to find out what's the reason for all these timeouts. And it's usually continuously extended to also include web services and so on. The last thing what I wanted to mention here, it's Google. That's basically like one of the largest distributed systems in use today. And if we look at the situation that, I mean, 2010, it had 88 billion queries a month. I mean, nowadays it's a lot more. I didn't see any statistics of it. It did not really have any major outages since its service in 98. In the book from Coulouris, which I provided in the literature, there's really a detailed case study of Google in it, the new book from 2012. And if somebody is interested, he can look at it. Then it provides something like, it provides software as a service, this SaaS, and then it provides also a platform as a service. And if you know, there's also hardware as a service. That's not really so much provided by Google. Google basically provides this service support on the software side or on the platform side, software side, especially if you look at Google Docs, which provides an office environment to handle documents. Then you have like Google Wave for a collaboration environment, Maps, Earth. Why do I have Google Wave twice here? Well, I don't know. I mean, it's the same thing here. And then also what they provide, a Google App Engine that you can basically can access apps and use it. The way how it's structured is a physical infrastructure. Therefore, it has two or three levels. First of all, it has racks where it puts a lot of machines in it, like 40 to 80 PCs. They have a network connectivity with a high-speed network. Then a number of racks are included into clusters, and these are basically also, let's say 30 and more racks put into a cluster, and then you basically put clusters together into one site, and you know that Google usually is always close to an area where they have like good cooling facility, like on the West Coast, or basically they have very easy use cooling facilities, and then they have especially high storage facility. Yeah, it's like in an exabyte scale. I have to look it up. How much is it? 18 bytes of storage. It uses, I just want to quickly finish that, a special middleware. Here, that's an important part of it, publish and subscribe. It uses like event notification. If something changed, it notifies immediately all its subscribers. Subscribers, I mean here Google subscribers. And then protocol buffer, that's something like similar like RMI. And it's like a transfer of, it's a transfer protocol, and it's 3 to 10 times smaller than XML, and in operation 10 to 100 times faster than XML processing. That allows a very fast processing. The other important part of it is this map and reduce. And therefore, it divides pieces, breaks data up into chunks, allows then parallel processing. It gets something like intermediate results, and then it combines it to the final result. So basically that allows for, let's say, distributed programming. It's programming a support to program, to write distributed programming, and it's a language for parallel execution. And the important part, I mean, you find that also in other environments, this map and reduce, divide things up, distribute it, and they use basically to program then the source cell, collect the intermediate results, and then combine it to the final results. I think here I will stop and...